afternoon. We'll call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order today. Today we have with us Senator, what's her name? Hughes. Isn't that terrible? And Senator Keel, Senator Coghill, Chairman, getting old. And then today we have Nancy Hemingway with us doing the recording. So all the talking we get to do, she gets to record it. And then Carson Walters. And with us today is Sean Ayers, who's doing committee aid. Senator Reinbold, welcome to the committee. And we're just now getting started. Today we only have one item on today's calendar, and that is the we're dealing with the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force, and we'll hear from them. We have with us Richard Bloomquist.
Josh Lowers.
I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm sorry. And then we have
Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson.
And you're going to bring us through what the Justice Act Task Force has done.
Yes, we
And
will.
Would you introduce the task force that are here present with
yes.
us when you get a chance? Anything before we get started for the committee members?
All right. Mr. Chairman, can I just apologize for being a minute late?
Apology accepted.
We were out getting a car at the ferry.
Oh, man.
And so I had told your staff that we were probably going to be a few minutes late. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, that has caused us no small stir in the whole world that we have to live in down here. First of all, this is our first meeting of the Judiciary Committee with me as chairman. I want to thank the previous chairman for all the work that she's done. And there is more to do, obviously. So what we're going to hear today is not only a layout of what is going on with the children in Alaska, but what we can do to help. And so this is primarily federally driven. So I will let you tell us the background to this, who is with you today. And then the question for me is, do we ask you questions along the way, or do you want to have moments where you pause for questions?
If it's possible, maybe we just pause between the portions where I present and Josh presents, and then definitely, I think we've left enough time at the end for questions as well.
Okay, Kathy. So, Kathy or Doctor?
Kathy is fine.
And then Josh, preferred? Is it Josh?
Or Josh is great.
All right, thank you. And then I did already announce Richard Bloomquist, who is our Health and Social Services guy, that he is on where are you at? Right there. I'm sorry. And then Gail, I should know that, shouldn't I, Gail? Well, so just to let you all know, there was a time that I was supposed to introduce a niece of mine, and when I stood up to announce her name, it wouldn't come up to my head. So every once in a while, it happens.
They say that this gets better with age.
With that, today, the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force is going to present to us, and then you just prompt us when you think it's appropriate time, Doctor, all right? Put yourself on the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson. I am the co-medical director of Alaska CARES and the medical director for the Children's Place. Those, respectively, are our child advocacy centers in Anchorage and in Wasilla.
And I'm Josh Lowers, a senior program officer for Covenant House Alaska. And we serve runaway homeless youth, 13 to 24, and serve trafficked youth as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So we do... we did want to give credit where credit was due for some of the data so that that we'll be quoting during our presentation, so we wanted to give you those references. So we are, the Children's Justice Act Task Force is federally mandated and funded, and you can see our mission. So we are supposed to look at areas where our system can be improved and how it responds to child abuse in our state. We are multidisciplinary. We have representation from all over the state. We have helped with legislation in the past to improve the system and help hold offenders accountable and provide more protection for children. And really our focus has been, in addition to child abuse in Alaska, other ways that we can improve the system, including clarifying and improving our mandatory reporting process and helping our multidisciplinary teams to work better together. And we're actually in the process of updating both our mandatory reporting training that we do, that we provide statewide, as well as our guidelines for the MDT response to child abuse. So I would like to ask the other members of our task force that are here if they could just stand and be acknowledged.
Please, just say your name. Stand. Just shout off your name. I know Pam. So Pam, start with you. First of all, sincerest thanks for the work that you do, and many of us have not only followed your work, but followed the recommendations down through the years. I know that the Children's Advocacy Centers are in statute because of much of your work, and have been greatly helpful to both the police, but mostly the victims, and so they don't get re-victimized. And so from there and beyond, we have looked forward to the recommendations. So thank you. Please accept that from this committee as a whole.
Thank you. Today, what we'll talk about is some of the newest research that's coming out, actually from our epidemiologists here in Alaska, some of the impact that we see from child abuse here in our state, some of the opportunities for earlier intervention, and that's one of the legislative issues that we were going to bring up towards the end with you. Josh is going to talk about what's going on with commercial sexual exploitation of children in our state, with some thoughts about the current proposed legislation. And then we have some specific requests that we'll bring to you.
Thank you.
Before we sort of dig into this, we wanted to just remind everybody of ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences. So is everybody pretty familiar with the Adverse Childhood Experiences studies, which, you know, very briefly was a collaborative study between the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and Kaiser Permanente, which is an HMO, a health maintenance organization in San Diego, where everybody who's enrolled, usually because either they or their spouse is employed, that's their health insurance plan, everybody gets all of their care. So they get their outpatient care, their hospital care, their prescriptions, all of that gets done through the same system, so they have access to a lot of data. And they asked over 17,000 participants to complete a questionnaire about things that happened to them before they turned 18. So they were questions about both different kinds of abuse, so physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, as well as physical and emotional neglect. So physical neglect, not getting your basic needs met. Emotional neglect means getting belittled and not having supportive caregivers in your life. And then also five different categories of household dysfunction. So that included mental illness in a parent or caregiver, somebody in the family that went to jail or prison, seeing your mom get beat up, substance abuse in the family, or losing a parent through divorce or separation. And this was what I think probably what people would consider to be a low-risk group. So average age was 57, so they were middle-aged, they were mostly Caucasian, and the majority of them had at least some kind of college education. And like I said, either they or their spouses were employed. So one of the things that was really surprising to these researchers was the fact that only about a third of people reported none of these categories of either abuse, neglect, or family dysfunction. So two-thirds had experienced at least one of those. And they were surprised at how common they were. So just, you know, you can see over a quarter of these, what we would consider low-risk adults, had been physically abused. Over 20% had been sexually abused. And there were pretty high rates of substance abuse in the family. Over a quarter of them had experienced substance abuse in their families. Almost a quarter had lost a parent through divorce or separation. And the other surprising thing was that it wasn't just one bad thing. So if they had experienced one of these categories, there was an 87% chance that they had experienced more than one, and a 50% chance that they had experienced three or more of these. And then what the researchers did was to look at their adult health and their sort of adult social issues and problems. And they found that the higher the ACE score, the more likely they were to have this whole host of all of the most common causes of disease and death in our country today. So they even found, for example, that their ACE score, which is how many categories they'd experienced, was a better predictor of risk for heart disease than all the traditional things that I was taught as a family doctor. So, you know, smoking and a family history and diet and things like that. So ACE score was actually a better predictor of risk. And then they also found that the ACE score was linked to a whole host of social problems that we see today. So that included what we consider to be, you know, bad lifestyle choices like smoking and drinking and using drugs, but also was linked to depression, suicide attempts, linked with intimate partner violence, and linked with rape. So people with high ACE scores were much more likely to be treated violently as adults and much more likely to be victims of sexual assault as adults. So,
Doctor, just to welcome Senator Machicki and to let him know that we're now on the Child Abuse in Alaska heading of this particular thing. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've actually collected some ACEs data for Alaska as well. And again, similarly to what they found in San Diego, only about a third of Alaskans report that they've never experienced any of these, and over two-thirds report that they've experienced at least one of these categories of adverse childhood experiences. And similar to what they found in San Diego, the people who had these high ACE scores, four or greater, which are much more likely to be unemployed, to live in poverty, and to have poor medical health and poor mental health as well. And similarly to this big study that was done through the Centers for Disease Control, here in Alaska, it's also not just one bad thing. So it's really confusing at first to look at this graphic here. But if you look at, for example, the top line where it looks at physical abuse, so if an Alaskan had a history of being physically abused as a child, there was an almost 36% chance that they'd also been sexually abused, over a 78% chance that they'd been verbally or emotionally abused. You know, the 60+% that one of their caregivers was engaging in substance abuse, over a 50% chance that they had witnessed their mom beat up. So again, it's not just one bad thing that happens. We know that there is, from this research and other research we'll talk about in just a minute, that this burden of maltreatment is significant in Alaska. I was really shocked to realize that at least 10% or more of Alaskan children receive a report to the Office of Children's Services. Somebody is worried enough about this child to make a report to the Office of Children's Services for 1 out of 9 to 1 out of 10 Alaskan children each year. There's over a third of Alaskan adults who, not counting these forms of family dysfunction, but just including abuse or neglect, over a third of Alaskans report experiencing abuse or neglect when they were children. And we are finding that kids accumulate these ACEs starting in very early childhood. And so there is, and I'll talk more about this in a second, but there's a 37% of Alaskan children will have a report to the Office of Children's Services by the time they're 9 years of age. We also know that these trauma impacts start even prior to babies being born. And I remember when I was in training, and this was decades ago, but when I was in training that I remember being told, well, babies are really well insulated, and so stresses to mom don't really have an impact on baby because they're insulated from all of that. And that was actually the wrong information, and we understand a lot more about that now. And we know that trauma and stress and other environmental exposures can create changes in both brain development and in genetics. So an example is fetal alcohol syndrome. So you guys are all familiar with that, and that prenatal exposure results in impacts on the brain, impacts on cognitive abilities and behavioral problems potentially through the rest of the lifespan for some children. Another thing that people may not realize is that there are other kinds of stressors. So there was a study that was done on mothers who lost either a spouse or a child when they were pregnant, and then they looked at the health of that baby that she was carrying as they grew up. And they found that those babies, as they grew up, were much more likely to be hospitalized for asthma. And you're going, well, how does that happen? And that kind of gets us into epigenetics. So epigenetics is how our gene expression gets influenced by our environment. So our genes, just really simply, they're the blueprints. They tell our cells what to do and how to function and how to make proteins and other compounds. And our genes can be turned on or off, and that's epigenetics. So it's whether a gene is turned on or turned off. And it may be a gene that's a gene for illness, that can be certain kinds of illness that can be turned on or off. And one of those genes is for asthma. Or it can also be a gene that's a protective gene that helps to keep you from getting an illness. And again, that can be turned on or off. So we know that trauma and stress can actually affect that turning off and on of genes. The other thing is that once that gene is turned on or off, that's something that can get passed along to the next generation. So it helps to then account for some of the intergenerational transmission of trauma that we see in our state and we see elsewhere. So ACEs really was about looking at adults, looking back at what happened in childhood. And here in Alaska, we're being very, very innovative in our maternal child health epidemiology department and actually looking at kids and going forward. So using information that's gathered from PRAMS, which is the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, that telephone calls are made to moms that have had babies here in our state, and they gather a lot of information about how that pregnancy and delivery went, and as well as things that happened in the year prior to becoming pregnant. And then they're following a cohort of kids. It's over 33,000 children born in Alaska between 2009 and 2011, and using a lot of different data sources that have been linked to be able to see what happens to these children. And what they're finding is that actually the risk factors that are identified for moms, so these different kinds of household dysfunction, similar to the ACEs research, but also looking at financial stress, so poverty with mom, that actually we can start predicting the children that are going to be at highest risk for developing their own ACEs by the time they're three. So not only children that are going to be exposed to these different forms of household dysfunction, but also children that are going to end up being abused or neglected. So one of the sort of proxies for accumulating ACEs is really that report to the Office of Children's Services, because that's the way many times these things come to attention, is that somebody's worried about abuse or neglect, they make a report to OCS. So the more of these pre-existing prenatal household dysfunctions that are present, the more likely it is that a child is going to be accumulating their own ACEs and to be reported, that there'll be a report made about them, a report of concern to the Office of Children's Services. And even when they adjust for how old mom is and how much education mom got and what her race is, it's still the curve remains the same. So the more of these pre-existing prenatal household dysfunctions, risk factors that are present, the more likely it is that this child is going to end up with their own set of ACEs. So we know that impacts start before babies are born, but we also know that they happen, that these kind of stressors can continue after birth. And the brain that This graph shows that at birth, babies have a relatively undeveloped brain. They're going to make lots of new neurons and new connections between the neurons, which are called synapses, as they get older. And that first few years of life is incredible. You know, they learn all those basic skills of, you know, learning how to breathe and coordinate breathing and swallowing and all of that. But then they learn to walk and talk, and they start they start learning things that they share with us as their parents. So that explosion of all of these little neuronal connections is pretty incredible in that first 5 or 6 years of life. And then when kids hit their teen years, they go through a pruning process. So these synaptic connections that they haven't been using, it's kind of like doing your computer doing an update. So I remember older computers, there was a button you could push that would defrag it. So it would get rid of connections that you weren't using, things, these fragments of things that you weren't using. So that the teen brain does the same thing. And then teens form all of these new connections that their brains need to have in order to be hopefully better functional adults. And this also makes the teen brain really vulnerable to the impacts of any further stress or trauma, and to the impacts of alcohol or drugs or any other poor decisions that they're making. And some of the pruning and new development that takes place is actually in that top part of the brain that's responsible for making good decisions. And, you know, so if any of you have ever had teenagers, if you feel like you've gone through a time where you feel like they have half a brain, they really do. But the good news is they form lots of new connections, and it gets better.
I was going to say, I remember when my kids were in their 2 and 3, they were geniuses. The older they got, the less it was.
And the less smart we got as their parents.
But that explains a lot, though. I mean, that's great.
So there's brain science.
It's a serious topic, but that was a funny point. So.
So we know that development of their brains and their bodies is going to be influenced by really positive things, and the influence on their epigenetics, that they're influenced by really positive things, but they're also influenced by these negative things as well. So we don't want kids accumulating ACEs, because we know it's going to modify their brain development. We know it's going to modify their genetics, and it's going to lead to this whole host of social ills and physical and mental problems as they get older. So here's this study that's being done that shows as children get older here in our state, this cohort of 33,000+ children, as they get older, their risk of accumulating their own ACEs, of having contact with the Office of Children's Services, continues to climb. And this is an ongoing study. So over time, we're actually going to be able to have data on these children as they hit their teen years and beyond. So by the time children in our state right now are 9, 1 out of 3 of them will have a report made to the Office of Children's Services, a report of concern. 1 out of 4 of them will have a screened-in report. 1 out of 8 will have a substantiated report. And 1 out of 16 will end up being placed into the foster care system. And the reason that this looks a little bit different than that about 1 out of 10 children per year is this is an accumulation of things. And so by the time many times you get to these kids, that the 1 out of 16 that are going into foster care, these are kids that have already had 17 or 20 reports to the Office of Children's Services or where there have been really grave concerns. So in 2019, screened in reports to the Office of Children's Services, I mean, we often think, oh, it must be physical abuse is the most common thing, or sexual abuse. And actually neglect is the most common reason that kids get removed almost 60% of the time. Neglect is also the most common cause of death in children in our state today. So, and neglect is the neglect-related deaths are often related to parental substance abuse. So it is a parent that goes to bed with their baby, and the parent's under the influence, and they roll over on their baby, and their baby asphyxiates. It's the parents that are under the influence and aren't aware that their child has wandered out of the home and fallen into the slough and drowned. Or sometimes it's not related to substance abuse. Sometimes it may be a parent that just doesn't buckle their child into their seatbelt, and their child ends up being ejected from the car in a car accident and dies. So those are all forms. Remember that neglect is failing to meet basic needs and failing to protect your child. Mental injury is the next most common reason that kids get a report to the Office of Children's Services. And the majority of those are exposure to domestic violence, which we know definitely has an adverse impact on kids' brains and development. You guys already know that we see a lot of domestic violence in our state. And then physical abuse accounts for a little over 11% and sexual abuse 6.6% of the reports that are made. So kids can have different life trajectories depending on, you know, the environment into which they're born. When they have this stable foundation, they're able to have, you know, this optimal brain development. They have the ability to calm themselves. They feel overall safe, which allows their brain to do a better job of forming relationships and of learning. And they have fewer risk factors as adults for health and well-being, as opposed to children that are living in an environment where there's a lot of trauma and chaos and where they're feeling unsafe or threatened much of the time. And they're where their brain is going to operate is in the brainstem. You know, they're focused on survival, on fight, flight, or freeze. And unfortunately, some of those fight, flight, or freeze neural pathways, that kind of response to stress, can be hardwired. And those are not necessarily the best ways to respond to stressful situations when you're an adult. And their genetic expression may change and could get passed along to the next generation. And we know they're at much higher risk for their adult health and well-being. The other thing we wanted to talk about, because again, this is sort of brand new research, is that we see this disproportionality. So we know that Alaska Native and American Indian children are disproportionately represented in child maltreatment reports and in child maltreatment or just child deaths in general. They're more than three times as likely to be reported to the Office of Children's Services, and they account for 48% of the children that are seen in our Alaska Child Advocacy Centers, compared to only about 14% of our total population. So we have brand new research here in Alaska that shows that absolutely there's no biological or cultural link between Alaska Native American Indian people and sexual abuse. It is not a cultural thing. It is not a racial thing. We have this sort of background of historical trauma and racism, and risk instead is really related to those social determinants that we've talked about. So when you look at, if you start accounting for things like poverty, intimate partner violence, substance use in the home, poor mental health of a parent or caregiver, that accounts for that disproportionality that we see. So the question that we end up needing to ask is not what's wrong with you, but what's happened to you. And we need to be addressing that sort of what's happened to you and how do we prevent that from happening to you. And it's expensive for a state. So it costs us a lot in social ills in our state, but there's very real financial costs. Somewhere between, depending on whether you use really, really conservative estimates or you use estimates that take into account somebody's future productivity, for example, lost work time, things like that, somewhere between $631 million to $10.7 billion each year for our state. And when we look at, for example, just substantiated reports to the Office of Children's Services, that ends up costing about $82 million a year alone just for the health care of abused kids, for child welfare, so paying for our OCS workers, for special education for these kids whose brains aren't going to do a good job of learning. It's estimated that over 40% of our adult Medicaid enrollment can be linked back to ACEs, because the higher your ACE score, the more likely you are to be on Medicaid. And it's been calculated that if we could decrease our ACEs burden in our state and do a better job of responding to child maltreatment, we could save our state at least $92 million annually just in the costs related to Medicaid, smoking, diabetes, binge drinking, arthritis, and obesity. So we're looking, there's a potential for a significant help with our budget as it is right now. So did you guys have any questions at all? And then I'm going to let Josh.
That is a lot of information. And it's like a It's like a thud to us because we have many times have seen these issues come before us. But Senator Reinbold, you had something you'd like to bring up.
Yes, the slides aren't numbered. So through the chair, it's the Alcan Link study.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, so basically you said 33,417 is the number that looks like it's studied amongst the children born in Alaska. And then in the first part, it's 1 in 3, and then of those, 1 in 4. And then of the substantiated, 1 in 8, and then actually removed from their house is 1 in 16. So it's hard to overlay this on, you know, the total population. But do you have an estimate of how many per 100,000 kids are removed from a household by OCS?
I don't have an idea of how many per 100,000. And actually, those are that's cumulative. So it's 1 out of 16 children that are removed. I'm sorry if I didn't completely understand your question. So it's 1 out of 3 total children in the state, 1 out of 4 total children in the state, 1 out of 8, 1 out of 16 for cumulative incidents by the time that they turn 9.
Through the chair?
Senator Rainbow.
So through the chair, so are you saying 1 in 16 children are removed from?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am. In this cohort of children.
Amazing. Okay, thank you.
It is amazing. It is amazing. And we try to figure out every way we can to increase our economy because I think everybody recognizes that the economic strata is one of the conditions that we're going to have to deal with. But there's more to it than that. I get that. Doctor, thank you very much. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, and thanks for being here. Sorry I missed the beginning, but I think I caught up. It would be interesting to see these numbers in comparison to the national average in other states. Is that something that's been collected? Do we know?
Through the chair, it is often difficult to compare between states. Those comparisons that have been done over the years, Alaska often runs in the top 5 of reported rates of child maltreatment. Different states do sometimes have different definitions and different ways that they screen reports in or substantiate or not. And so that accounts for, we can say Alaska does rank way up there. But it can be difficult to have exact, accurate numbers.
Senator Machicki, to continue.
In any way, do you rank ACEs from sort of soul-crushing to something less? I mean, they're not all created equal, right? I think we would agree with that. Do you weight them in your studies?
Through the chair. That's a fabulous question that a lot of folks are very interested in, and there is some research where people are starting to look at the impact of how do you weight ACEs. Some of that impact, though, has to do not just with the particular category of ACE, but how many times it happened, how old the child was when it happened, did they have a caring, supportive adult in their life who was there for them? Did they get any therapy or treatment? So it does make it challenging to know for sure what the weight of different ACEs are. But that is a question that's been looked at nationally.
And it's a good question because, for example, those of us who are on the education committee, we hear this brought up often. And quite often they talk about ACEs trauma and not discounting the fact that it's trauma, but it doesn't give a scope to it. It makes it, it can take it to the worst or it can take it to the lightest. And but they do talk about ACEs scoring. And so I will give them that. But they usually lead with the word ACEs trauma. And then we start from there. But we don't always know what that means. So we keep trying to figure it out. So hence this meeting here today to start with some of the things, not only in the scoring of it, but some of us, for example, know that once somebody gets into the OCS or foster care system, there's a continuation of the trauma in a variety of different ways. With our doing our dead level best to help. So sometimes dysfunction might be better than that trauma. And so we always are struggling on how do we balance that. So sometimes the government, who wants to help desperately, can make it worse. And sometimes the families are dishing up things that are just so horrendous that the youngster is not only in dire need, but can't get the help needed. So we struggle with all those things. So, in fact, Josh is going to bring us to this next thing, which actually takes us even deeper into some of the issues that we're going to deal with. And then I did read the end of the slide presentation. They're going to get to some suggestions, and that will be probably cause us to have a lively conversation, just to say the least. So, Josh, you're up.
Thank you.
Senator?
I just used my handy-dandy calculator. So if one out of 16 is removed from the home, that would be 6,250 out of 100,000 for Senator Reinbold's question. Or about 6 children out of 100. So that's just how it breaks out, which is pretty astonishingly high.
Good anecdotal. Josh.
Okay, thank you. So, yeah, so we wanted to, due to the bills.
Put your name on the record.
Yes, Josh Lowers.
I don't have to mispronounce it.
All right, Josh Lowers. Yes, Covenant House, Alaska. So due to the bill being put forth by the governor, HB 225 and SB 165, we wanted to spend just a few minutes talking about human trafficking specifically and commercial sexual exploitation of children being the broad scope of that. So working at Covenant House, I've been there 8 years. A number of years ago, we learned that our population was highly vulnerable to being trafficked. We were told that by the FBI, and we were surprised at the time. And then we got to work learning about what we needed to do about it. And since then, we've been able to be leaders in the state. I've traveled the state training folks how to identify and serve victims, all law enforcement, service providers, other folks. And so this is a 10-minute version of sometimes a 2-day training, so I'll try to go quick. But so commercial sexual exploitation of children is the broad umbrella that sex trafficking fits into. And so one of the things that we do when we come to this issue is we have to look at the language, because for many years in our culture, there's been perception issues around what's actually happening. And as an example, prostitution in our culture is fairly new to being recognized as something, particularly with children, as an issue. As an example, the first federally prosecuted case of sex trafficking was here in Alaska in the early 2000s. It was the dancers who came over from Russia. And so that was the first one ever in our whole country. So this as an issue, as something that we've responded to as a country, is not something that we're very far along the road on. But we need to be able to think through, how we speak about this issue. And so that's where, one, we think about commercial sexual exploitation of children, and that being the broad, that helps us to see this as child abuse. And because what we know is that here in our state, folks who are commonly, when they're recruited into this lifestyle, it's between 14 and 16 years old. So many of the young people who are out on the street, who folks would say are, who might look older or who they would say might be choosing this lifestyle, are actually children. They can't consent to sex act. They've been recruited. I'll talk a little bit about that. But one of the things that I do when I train is I ask folks, I say, what are the words, what stereotypes come to your mind when I say the words teen prostitute? And folks often give me things like, they're wearing scantily clad, they're scantily clad, they're drug addicts, they're bad kids, they're making bad choices, and that sort of stuff. And I get, the Julia Roberts kind of stereotypes. Then I ask them, what comes to your mind when you think of a sexually exploited child? And then I get a bunch of different responses. I get folks who are thinking about victims, folks who are thinking about people who are not making choices to do these things but are being exploited by other people. And that is the key to the beginning of the change of response for us when it comes to human trafficking, because folks, if we're viewing these young people as sexually exploited children, we respond to them differently. Different systems respond to them. They get services, they get help, they get support. If they're viewed as teen prostitutes and they're making bad choices and they're bad kids, then we respond with law enforcement. We criminalize them. And so this is the key to the beginning of this. So our words matter. And there is no such thing as child prostitution. There's sexual exploitation of children. So when you're talking about trafficking, so it's, like I said, trafficking fits underneath the umbrella of CSEC. But for it to be trafficking, there needs to be a third party exploiter. So a third party, someone else who is benefiting from the sex act. So that doesn't have to be money. It could be drugs. It could be some other thing that they're trading. But there's a third party who's benefiting from that sex act. And to be able to prosecute someone for sex trafficking, you would need to, nationally, you would need to be able to prove force, fraud, or coercion had happened if they were over the age of 18. In our state, in 2012, there was a whole group that came together to work on this issue, and they raised that to 20 in our state. So you don't have to prove force, fraud, or coercion if someone is 20 age 20 or under, which means that if anyone is benefiting from a sex act from this other person, they are a trafficking victim, period, in our state. If they're older than that, then they'd have to prove force, fraud, or coercion. Just a little picture to show how this fits as a form of child abuse. That within our rings of child sexual abuse, sexual exploitation, then comes the commercial sexual exploitation of children, and then the sex trafficking of minors, all within that. But again, as we think about this as a child abuse issue, this will reframe the way that we do the work. So, pathways of entry in our state. We have folks, we have parents who are selling, trading their children in different situations for sex. That happens here, both urban and rurally. We have scenarios where young people are kind of brought in by force. I have heard less kind of kidnapping type stories in our state, but there are definitely scenarios where folks are being kind of groomed and a relationship is being built with them. They're offering basic needs. You know, many of the young people who are drawn into this are folks who are homeless. And so they have no other, they don't have their basic needs being met. And so somebody shows up to try to meet those basic needs for them. And then they start to recruit. That could be through a seduction, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend type relationship. But then it turns violent. All traffickers do things differently. Some are extremely violent. We had a trafficker, Jerry Starr, about a decade ago, who was picked up. He had 50 plus women and girls that he was running in Anchorage. And inside of one of his houses, he had a box built, and he would put people in there and starve them. When they had gotten folks free and they had arrested him, they asked them, you know, or there wasn't a lock on the door. It wasn't locked when law enforcement got there. And they said, why didn't you leave? The door wasn't locked. And they said, I didn't even know the door was unlocked because I didn't touch it, because there was so much fear because of the violence of that situation, that he was either going to hurt them or he was going to hurt the other women and girls, and then blame it on them. So it's like this coercive, violent process. Further, we are starting to see more kind of this blackmail stuff with the internet. There's, you know, in my 8 years and working with folks from the FBI and law enforcement, and other service providers, almost all the youth that I know who have been trafficked, and in part because where my work is, but even working with them, these are really highly vulnerable youth who have been in systems. They've been on the street, that sort of stuff. We're starting to see more youth who are being blackmailed via the internet. So there's somebody who's convincing them to send a nude picture or an explicit image or something like that, and then they're blackmailing them to do sex acts. So we have more folks that they're starting to see who are from fairly, you know, regular homes, and have fairly stable support systems, who are maybe even living at home, but are doing sex acts and things, and their families don't know about it because of this blackmailing piece. We also have folks who are they're modeling, acting, dancing. I knew a young person who, she was a beautiful singer, and she was downtown Anchorage singing on the corner, and a man drove up and said, "Hey, you have a beautiful voice. I can make you a star. We have a gig in Seward tonight. Come along." She went along with him. And when they got to Seward, it was not what she thought it was. It was one of these trafficking type situations. Luckily, in that situation, there was a well-informed hotel attendant who noticed something and stepped in, intervened, and helped her, and actually helped her get back to Anchorage. So in that situation, she wasn't trafficked. And that's one of the, as we get further down and we start to bring some of our recommendations, training around the state is so imperative, because these are the places where folks can intervene and help stop these things from happening. We do have some peer recruitment that happens, specifically like for us at Covenant House. We have folks who will send young people in to try to recruit out. We also have rural to urban and or urban to rural. So we have folks who have been recruited here, and then their trafficker will convince them or make them reach out to folks, their cousins, their sisters, their friends in the rural areas, and say, "Hey, I have a place for you to come. Come to Anchorage. There's a good job. There's good stuff." And then they come into this trafficking situation. And then we have situations, you know, where folks, as I said, folks are homeless and they have very little place to go. And sometimes they begin by trading sex themselves for a place to stay or a place, you know, some ways to survive. And then that turns into trafficking type situations. Just a couple of quick stats here. Within 48 hours of a young person becoming homeless, one in three of them in our country will be approached by a trafficker. We see that play out in our state. I said this already, that 14 to 16 years of age is the kind of the common, based on our experience and what we have with our local law enforcement. And just a national stat is that when somebody's recruited by a trafficker, their average lifespan after that is 7 years. Because of the violence of the trafficker, because of the violence of the folks who are buying the sex, and because of the other things that they can become a part of, as like, for example, traffickers who are getting folks addicted to drugs or other types of things, average lifespan, 7 years after being recruited, if they're not able to get out. Specific Alaskan risk factors. There's a national expert named Victoria Sweet. She came up a few years ago, and three things stood out to me from her presentation that were pretty poignant for us, I think. And she talks about risk factors for creating a market, supply and demand for trafficking. And what she talks about is populations with high amounts of historical trauma or trauma exposure. So much of what Dr. Baldwin Johnson was talking about with our young people, we have folks who have experienced lots of trauma. So what that means is that we have people who are vulnerable to this, to being recruited by exploiters. Then we have transient male-dominated industry. So what does that mean? That means people who will buy sex. So if we have folks on the slope, we have military, we have fisheries, we have all these folks all over our state that are kind of male-dominated industries where regular guys are leaving their context to go, you know, so John in Kansas, you know, who's a good, upstanding citizen, probably isn't going to buy sex because he's with his family and he's fine. But when he's alone on the slope for months, or if he's in another place, the potential that he might buy sex goes up. So then you take those things and you put them together in rural areas where you have less people to step in, like in the Seward situation where somebody saw something happening, and you have more opportunity for trafficking to happen. So we have all three of those things all over our state. And then we also, and this isn't just Alaska, but we have a celebrated history of prostitution. You can still, in Fairbanks, you can go to the gold miner days, and we're celebrating the brothels, and we're celebrating those things. You can go, you know, around college campuses, we have our pimp and hoe parties, and we have, like, there's all kinds of cultural things that don't see this trafficking piece as an issue, because they don't see it as trafficking. Again, we're talking about the language, right? They see these were choices that people have made, or their perception of the issue. So this is part of what we need to do, is be shaping the culture. And then some numbers for you. So in 2016, we participated through Covenant House International in a 10-site study. There's actually 30 Covenant House sites in the Western Hemisphere. But 10 of those cities came together to do a study. It was a labor study. And so they were asking young people, how are you making money? And 641 youth were surveyed nationally. And out of that, one in five youth were identified as trafficking victims. That's both labor and sex. In our state, we did 65, which is admittedly a small sample size, but we had one in four of those 65 youth that were identified as either labor or sex trafficking victims, and then it was actually 29% of our females for specifically sex trafficking victims of that 65. Additionally, Dr. Laura Murphy from Loyola University in New Orleans, who did this study, she came to us last, and so she had been to New Orleans and to LA and to Detroit and to New York, and when she finished up her last interview, she came out and said to me, the stories that I've heard of trafficking are the most horrific here in Alaska. I've been to all these places, but the violence and just the horrific things that people have experienced here are the worst that I've seen across the country. Additionally, we at Covenant House have been working with Awake and STAR and Priceless and Alaska Native Justice Center. We've been sharing a grant for the last 2.5 years, and we actually have just received some more funding to continue this work. But collectively, we served 200 victims in the last 2.5 years. That's not just minor victims, that's adults as well, but just so a picture of what we're starting to, the data we're starting to gather as we do this work, because that's always been part of the issue, is folks not believing that this is an issue because we don't have the data, and so we're getting some of that. FBI is currently working on 10 minor cases, and so they're not currently working any adult cases because they're focused on these minor cases. And then, as I said before, this increase in online recruitment, the blackmail type stuff. And the explicit images and that sort of stuff. So that was high speed.
So you said that you've been teaching people awareness issues. Can you give us kind of a template of how you begin to bring an awareness?
Yeah.
Obviously the statistics,
yeah.
But some of the things that you'll say, here's what you can notice, and you can speak up.
Sure.
With regard to what you see.
Yeah. Well, so first when I come to a community, I first start with that conversation so that we can shape the perception, and then walk through these processes of recruiting, grooming, and why do people stay, and the kind of coercive brainwashing. There's a number of things that happen to young folks for why they wouldn't leave this. But when it comes to red flags, we talk about things like for me, if I have a young person who walks through my door and they have a substance use issue, they have a mental health issue, they've been in foster care, and they've been in some sort of treatment, those to me are all extreme red flags, because that's somebody who is really vulnerable, and they're walking around on the street. So those aren't like specific. There's a lot more specific red flags, like things like IDs being stolen, you know, cash that shows up, other people around who are threatening, or older, like if we have, seems like we have somebody who's like a 40-year-old boyfriend, or something like that. Like those are kind of big indicators. But really at this point, we're really starting to look at, what are the factors that make people vulnerable to this, so that we can try to get folks ahead of them being trafficked. And those are the things. It's the mental health, it's substance use, it's being in systems involved. It just means that people's support systems haven't been able to help them, and that puts them vulnerable to somebody showing up and trying to meet those needs and then manipulating them.
Bobby, there's another part to this conversation that we can't have right here because this is your focus. But what I've heard is also in some of the hospitality industry,
mm-hmm.
The people that are changing the sheets or
yes.
doing the work in the kitchen also are under some kind of duress,
mm-hmm.
and it's not children necessarily, but it's people who
yeah.
come into our country. But during the summertime, we do have a lot of youngsters coming in during the tourism time,
mm-hmm.
and many of those are college age students, but they're probably over the 20. But that is also a vulnerable population, am I right?
You are, yes. And that's where I think particularly as we start to talk about this legislation, you know, leaning into the labor, that there's a place where the labor trafficking and the sex trafficking meet. And I think that it's important for us to look at this as a whole problem and not just, I mean, my expertise lies within the sex trafficking part, but we also, you know, like I said, in our study, we had young people, most of our young people who were being labor trafficked, it was things like being forced to run drugs for a gang or something like that. But the population that you're talking about is also very vulnerable.
The term mule comes to mind. They have youngsters sometimes trying to get through checkpoints with drugs. So, but the ACEs and how we can watch for our vulnerable population probably is going to be the focus of this as we look into the legislation. So questions at this point? I do have both Richard Blomquist and Gail who want to come up, I think, at this point. Not so? Okay, all right. They're just here available. They're members of this particular task force. So, Senator Machicki?
I know we're going to talk about the bill in the future, and I guess a curiosity for me is, what about the case in Seward? There's kind of the adult prostitute by choice. There's kind of the pimp thing with adults, and then there's the kind of animal that would exploit a child. And when I look at how the law should treat the three of them, I believe the sentence should be extremely short and severe for anyone that would hurt a child that way. And I think you know what I mean. Like, no freaking mercy whatsoever. None. What are we doing? What kind of pressure do we have on, first of all, how do you find these people and how do you get a hold of them? That is someone that should never have the right to walk the face of this earth again.
So, through the chair, and I think this is what's really important about this legislation, is that to be able to get that done, right, to get these bad guys who are really hurting young people, we have to have young people who are, because the way that we get them is by they testify or that they talk to us. And the only way to do that is through relationship. And so when we are moving a bill forward and we're thinking about that, like, how do we get the bad guys? Then we also have to be thinking about, how do we get young people to be able to share what's happening to them? And that is, without a service component to this, and being able to, and we have nonprofits that are working on this stuff. We have some coordination with law enforcement, but one of the things that we propose is a safe harbor legislation, which is a specific track for minors when they're identified. It's a service track, and that would be a collaboration of OCS, DJJ, service providers to be able to come together to support these folks. Because one of the things that happens is, one, they're afraid to, if you get to court, they're afraid to go in front of their trafficker. So they need a lot of support to even get to that point. But they also, they don't make great witnesses. Because these are young folks who, like, when I've talked about somebody who's been through the system, you know, they have all these, they have probably a record by this time because of the things they've been trying to do. And so when they sit in a courtroom, folks are like, oh, well, this doesn't, you look like a bad person. This is essentially what happens.
It comes back to what you were saying earlier. If there was a transaction that was cash-based, even a youngster can't get the kind of help in a court that they're really needing.
Yeah.
So this is going to be what we're going to have to, when we get to the bill. Yeah. But that brings us to the point, and I'll bring it up, because what can we do is the next part of this little presentation. So you, a follow-up, and then Senator Keel.
I guess I really do get the service piece now. I've worked with a couple of organizations through the years with around young people that have had sexual abuse ACEs, sometimes repeatedly, and it takes a while just to turn the lights back on.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine how long it would take for that young person to be able to help, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to get the lights back on, and you all know the look I'm talking about. I get that. Thank you.
So you're talking to parents and grandparents here. I've got a 14-year-old granddaughter, for example. And I am on guard. But I mean, and as parents, same thing. Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess maybe to mark that transition, I know you said it, you could spend 2 days on it, but could you talk to us a little bit about why victims stay?
Yeah. Yes, through the chair. So I don't know if you ever heard of Stockholm Syndrome. There's a in the early 90s, I'm not sure when it was, but there was a bank robbery that went kind of awry, and there was a moment where the police in Stockholm did some kind of shady maneuvers to try to get the bad guys out. And what happened is the folks who were there had held captive bonded with them. It's called a trauma bond, and so they actually became connected to the people who were keeping them trapped, and they thought, and so the bad guy became the police who were trying to get them out. And the same thing happens. It's this process of grooming where someone builds a relationship. It's not that different than like a domestic violence relationship where there's a little love, there's some love, and then there's violence, and then there's pain, and then there's more love and a little bit of love. And the other part of this to recognize, particularly with young people who have been on the street, is that they've had a lot of bad relationships in their lives. And so even in a situation where someone is hurting them, that might still be the best situation that they've been in. So for them, they don't have a different frame of reference. But the term is called a trauma bond. So when you're bonded, you become bonded to this person in trauma. But then I also, one of the things that I do when we're training is I'll ask people, if you were going to brainwash somebody, how would you do it? And spend some time thinking through how you would do that, because that's what happened. Like these are fairly sophisticated folks that are they're brainwashing young people through a whole processes of coercion and violence and gifts and then fear and all of that and drugs. Yeah,
it could be anywhere from like you say, basic needs to just pure naivety.
Right.
So, Senator Rainbow.
Thank you. First of all, thank you both for being here. I find this to be very educational. It's a hard topic to talk about, and it's a sad topic. But I want to, just deal with Alaska in general just for a few moments. I did not confirm a vote on Walt Monaghan, the Department of Public Safety official under Walker about 6 years ago, because when I called him and we talked in my office for about an hour, he says 1% of rapists end up in jail in Alaska, roughly. And I was like, that is outrageous. I mean, I was like freaking out, like, this is not okay. I was like, I was outraged by this. And he was like, yeah, it's just the way it is. And I was like, what's your plan? If you want to be the commissioner, what's your plan? How are we going to fix this? And it's like, don't know, no answer, no solution. And I was just absolutely mortified. And I told him, you're not getting my vote, period. If you don't take this so seriously, this is driving up our budget. It's ruining our state. It's destroying our families. It's just, to me, completely out of control. So I think this is a critical area that we take by the horns, and we have to do something about it. So on to Senator McChickie's. These people shouldn't see the light of day if they have done something horrific like this to a child. I don't think we take our laws serious enough in here. This is a known, soft place. And I think it's real serious that we do need to get tougher on these issues, because in some countries, there's zero tolerance. I mean, there's death penalty. It is not accepted. It's not tolerated here. Where up here, it's just like, it's sad to see some of the rural communities and what's happened out there. And I've talked to some of the people and gone and visited some of these places. And it's like, where is that guy? You know what I mean? And they cover for each other in some of these communities. And, man, I really think we need to address this. And I think we need to address it head on. And I hope whatever this piece of legislation does it and is not a little slap on the hand or a little soft pull here or there. We need to go head on, and we need to deal with this, and we need to root these people and get them out or get them locked up.
That will bring us. That will bring us to what to do, and I want to give them ample time to get into the what shall we do slides. So, yes, ma'am, Senator.
The what's to do. The study that we showed that we're actually worse than places like LA or the different places, and that our rates are worse. Ours are 1 in 4. Theirs is 1 in 5. One of the things I was wondering, what's that difference for Alaska? So you get back with us later on that. And then the other thing that is horrific in this presentation is the fact that there are parents there that are commercially exploiting their children. And I was wondering if maybe that's a difference here in Alaska. I just cannot imagine that that is happening in our state. And if you could shed light on that at some point, if you don't want them to answer it now, that's fine. But
thank you, Senator Hughes. If you want to address that now, or you can get folded into what can we do. But
I can fold it in.
Josh, go ahead.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and go through this PowerPoint and then bring that point up as appropriate. Doctor.
Thank you. So we want children to have the very best trajectory for their lives that we can. And we do know some of the things that will raise that trajectory up, as well as those things that make that trajectory go down for them. I do think we have reasons for hope. You know, clearly we have very dedicated people that are really interested and want to do something for kids. I do believe healing is always possible. I think there's, as more and more is known about brain science, our brains, even at my age, have the ability to still learn and to do some rewiring. And we certainly all have the ability to help build resilience in kids and to protect kids. So one of the things that's really important is to have earlier recognition and to have earlier and better intervention. So one of the gaps with mandatory reporting, or several of the gaps that we've noticed, which is one of our asks from you, is that I do trainings for usually each year for EMS providers and paramedics. And I just was doing training here this last fall in October and November for them. And one of the feedback points that they made was that they weren't specifically listed as mandated reporters. So I said, well, you know, you are practitioners of the healing arts. And they said, well, it's a long list and we're not on it. So that's one thing, actually, that would be a really simple, easy fix to add them to our list of mandated reporters. We have grave concerns that there's exemption for clergy, because not only have we had lots of cases in our state and nationally of clergy as perpetrators of child abuse, but also as protectors of perpetrators as well, trying to handle things themselves or within the church and not getting other people that might be able to help protect children better involved. We know that there is research that links animal cruelty and child abuse. So if an animal is being abused in a home, there is significant risk that those children are being abused as well. So there are many states that do have animal control and veterinary staff on their list of mandated reporters. And then our guardian ad litems here in this state. Right now our CASA, our court-appointed special advocate volunteers, are mandated reporters. But our GALs are not. So again, that'd be something that would, I think, would be a quick and easy fix. For judges, the reason we brought up the idea of judges and magistrates is that there was a case many of you may be aware of that happened around Thanksgiving, where a mother took her 13-year-old daughter in, who testified before a judge requesting a protective order because her stepfather had allegedly held a gun to her head and threatened to kill her. And the protective order was granted, but it was around Thanksgiving, and so it didn't get to law enforcement. These things get faxed to law enforcement. So it didn't get faxed to law enforcement because of the holidays and everything else that was happening, and a notice to Office of Children's Services wasn't made. And the stepfather has since been charged with killing both this 13-year-old girl and her mother, and then setting their car on fire. And so that it's not that the judge did anything wrong. The judge is not a mandated reporter, or magistrate maybe, and didn't. And there's no requirement at all for them to do anything but follow the protocol that they have. But we're thinking that judges and magistrates do see a lot of these cases where there's violence in the home, and we would just like to see some kind of mechanism that would allow for immediate notification in cases like this that are really high risk. This is just to remind you, one of the things that we do really well in our state is provide early and effective intervention through child advocacy centers. And we now have CACs through in almost all of our major hubs in Alaska, and have served nearly 33,000 children and their families since the first CAC opened in Anchorage in 1996. The FBI at a national level is actually signed a memorandum of agreement with the National Children's Alliance, so that child advocacy centers nationally and in our state are working towards being able to provide optimal services to child victims of sex trafficking.
And in Alaska, both state and federal dollars have gone to help our children advocacy centers, which is a great partnership. So.
Yes, sir. So we do know what the protective factors are, and we have as a society really need to focus on trying to up those protective factors, which really the focus is on adults. So providing that stable, safe, nurturing family with other caring adults that are around this child, with having households that have rules and boundaries that keep an eye on their kids, parents that are have employment and homes and a roof over their heads, have access to healthcare and other services, where communities are safe and where there's cultural connectedness for children and their families. So I think for all of us, we all need to recognize this is something that affects us in Alaska at many different areas of our state and within our society. We would ask that all of your decisions be made using that trauma-informed lens. So it's not what's wrong with you, it's what's happened to you. And for each of you, both in your work at the state level as well as in your own communities, to support those community-based and those system-wide approaches to strengthen children and families. And a number of our communities in the state do have these community coalitions that are doing this kind of work that really are geared towards more primary prevention and secondary prevention. So we have data now that says we have many Alaskan adults that are bearing the burden of a lifetime accumulation of family violence and dysfunction. We have data that shows us that Alaskan children are accumulating their own ACEs really early in their lives, and our economy and our society bears the cost of that. And so what we want to do is we want to decrease the dose and not have kids be have this lifetime burden and lifetime accumulation. So prevention, of course, is always the best. When we don't have prevention, we need early recognition and early effective and timely intervention. We need effective treatments, and we have to have effective legislation that helps to protect children and hold offenders accountable.
Okay. So through the chair, Senator Hughes, specifically when we're talking about parents selling, the two types of situations that I've experienced or been a part of are folks who are currently being trafficked, whether they be minors or adults, who have had children and are still in that lifestyle, and so they are growing up and that's happening within that lifestyle. The other is and this is where folks wouldn't probably even say it, they wouldn't even know that they're a trafficker. It's when they're trading drugs, or like there's a house party and 14-year-old daughter is there and somebody says, hey, you can have drugs if I can have sex with your daughter, or something like that. And that type of situation is where I have in our state seen that stuff play out. Then through the chair to you, Senator, I think and this is, as we talk about this, this piece of legislation specifically, I think it's three pieces. It's that, it's the penalty piece, it's going after the folks that are buying sex, which this is in this bill, and that's one of the things that we support, and then it's the service piece. If we can hit all three of those things and we do them together, then we accomplish all the goals, because we have less people buying, and if folks are supported, not only do they get out of it, but they can help us get the folks who are hurting them. And that's the kind of wheel of things that I see, or that we see as a task force. So we support the prosecution of the buyers. We support the vacating convictions of the prostitution convictions. So we also would add, and maybe this is the part you were talking about, that another barrier for young people is that when they're being coerced, when they're being forced to do things, sometimes they pick up other crimes. Like they get picked up for possession of drugs, they get picked up for theft, things of that nature. And so we would want to see an addition to that vacating prostitution conviction, some of these lower level convictions also being vacated, because those things all stand in the way of them getting what they need, housing, jobs. You know, those are the things that block the barriers, or become barriers for them when they're trying to leave the lifestyle. And I have personally seen young people who were ready to leave that lifestyle, or were ready to leave their exploiters, who needed services, who needed, you know, needed treatment or something else, didn't get it, and went back, or who said, I'm tired of trying to get this other stuff, I'm just going to go back because I can't, I tried to get the job and I couldn't get it, and I couldn't get into the housing because of the things that are on my record. And so that's why we would suggest the expanding of that piece of it. I did talk a little bit about Safe Harbor already, but really it's just a specific set of protections for minors and a system of response. And like I said, over the years that I've been working in this, we're growing that slowly, but it, we think a systemic kind of response to that, where there is a path built into the statutes for if we identify somebody, this is how they're going to move through OCS, or this is how they're going to move through DJJ, and this is how we're going to have our nonprofit providers work on this together. And very honestly, all the stuff that I'm talking about is already in the plan from 2012. We just never did it as a state. So we can look back to, there's a map, there's a whole roadmap, big stacks of paper, with really good recommendations that are still valid.
I'm going to stop you there for a second. Yeah. Only to say, some of the support services for some of the younger people is going to be critically important. For example, from personal experience, I've known of people who wanted to get out, got out, worked hard, couldn't make ends meet, and then the money was just too easy. And so that is a draw, that's a huge draw, especially if you just can't make it, and maybe you have a kid or something like that. And so those support services become critical for that point in their life.
Well, and that's the part where I've seen folks who were trafficking victims as 20, 21, 22-year-olds then choose to go into that lifestyle with other people to support them, because then they're actually are making money in that scenario, but then they're also vulnerable to being re-trafficked again. Like So then we also, we believe more training, specifically for law enforcement, for judges, for prosecutors, and I think that could expand even to, you know, curriculums for Department of Education, getting training for young people on particularly if they think it fits around internet safety. I think there's a place to really plug in some of this trafficking stuff there. So we have that. We also wanted to say that we support 160 SB 168, HB 228, particularly the victim notification and ability to testify, the clear criteria, accepting the registration from other states, and the additional, like, we like the reach back part of that piece of legislation, so that folks have to sign up on the registry.
It's important that we hear your passion. You can hear kind of it riles us significantly, rightfully so, but then when we hear these bills, it's going to get legally pedantic, right? So sure. This is important that we have this conversation at the outset. Senator Hughes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You answered part of my question as far as the situation, the horrific situation with parents exploiting their children. But what about the fact that our rates are higher than the rest of the country? Do you have you pinned that down to anything in particular? What is different? Why is it higher here?
Through the chair, I believe that the reason that, like, it's what we talked about with all the ACEs stuff. We top the nation in so many of the bad stats, and I think all that exposure to trauma and all that exposure to violence and all of that has created, I mean, if one in three young people by the age of 9 are having a report to OCS, the other part that we didn't even talk about that Dr. Parrish talks about is that the folks who are reported to OCS, whether or not they are screened in, have the same amount of ACEs that they've accumulated. So that means we have 1/3 of our young people who have really high ACE loads that they've collected. And so I think it comes down to supply, like particularly in this arena, it comes down to supply and demand. And there's a lot of young people and there's a lot of folks who could be recruited. And so somebody's going to take advantage of that. And they are. And additionally, like, folks can make 2 and 3 times on a sex act here in Alaska than they can in other places. So we do have other folks coming from other parts of the country up here, not even necessarily recruiting from our young people, but are bringing people here in the summer, blocking out rooms in hotels and selling because they can make more. So we have folks from Las Vegas and other parts of the West Coast coming up to do that. So I think that is also a factor.
The nice thing for us is our work with the FBI, our population movement is actually traceable Whereas if you're in Denver, you may not be able to trace so easily. So Denver, Las Vegas, places like that get very difficult because the smoke screen is so heavy. But here we know people coming and going, and so thank you for your work with the FBI. Senator Hughes?
Yeah, just that response that it's due to more ACEs in Alaska, that begs the question, why are there more ACEs in Alaska? And I just wonder if there's any research being done on that, if either of you know.
Through the chair, I do have thoughts about why we have such an ACEs burden, certainly, and there is a lot of historical trauma and intergenerational transmission of trauma in our state. We have had a significantly transient population in our history with people who do come up to work jobs temporarily here. Families that are not necessarily, they may be here, they're here just for the short term, maybe because it's military, maybe because of some other job, and they lack family supports around them, so they don't have auntie and grandma and grandpa and everything to be available to help provide support and education for parenting for these families. And we have a lot of substance abuse here, and so that's my personal, those are my personal theories about why we see such high rates here.
Yeah, it's interesting, being born and raised here, I've watched the alcohol issue in Alaska just kick the feet out from under us in a variety of different ways. And then you add a drug problem on top of that. And they both bring different sets of problems, but they're both dramatic problems. And so but once again, why do we even buy that stuff is the question, and we've tried to answer that. One thing that I watch, probably from my own background, is there's not only a health dynamic and a family dynamic, but a spiritual dynamic, and I know that many of us want to bring that into the issue as well for the value of your life, which at this point many people question. And so and there's many ways to look at the value of life, but at least from my perspective, I would bring that as part of the value, and why we should treat ourselves more nobly than we do. And so what you experienced today, you have already experienced in your own life, and that is we're amazed, we're angered. And that would properly motivate us if we do it right. So as we hear the bills, we'll look at how we can solve some of these problems. They're thorny problems in this regard. There's the system of helps that we have, the system of prosecution that we have, and the various different systems that work within those, right? And sometimes somebody is a perpetrator and a victim and need help on both accounts. And sometimes worthy of the capital punishment, sometimes can be redeemed. And there's the whole spectrum, right? And what you've done today is you've given us what I would call probably the deep-seated reason for us not to give an inch on this, but to forge our way forward. So for the work that you all get to do, I think you've made the proper impact. I would say from this committee, for us to take what is now put before us very, very seriously and look for ways that we can make it work well. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, just curious, and I don't know if it's part of this bill, but is there, are you tied in with law enforcement? The problem's invisible to many of us. It's probably happening under our noses and we don't know it. The public needs to be trained and be more aware as well, but I'd be willing to support additional funding for sting operations. And one way, I mean, the cycle has to be broken, but one way to break it from really bad people from somewhere else that are the narcissistic enough to know how to break someone and train them into this way of life, they're pretty crafty. And we're going to have to, I'm willing to invest in whatever it takes to root these people out. And I'm sure the five of us here would agree. Is that a part of the plan on how to identify? I mean, you, just business-wise, you have to make this be the worst state in the union in which to do business because the risk is too high of getting caught. And I think that's a gap that we have.
Mm-hmm. So, through the chair, this I know that this bill does raise penalties. I don't know that it makes us the most punitive in the you know country, but it does raise the penalties. I do know that the folks who are working on this on the law enforcement side is a pretty small team. It's like one APD officer and a few FBI officers that are the core or agents that are the core of this. There's some troopers that are working on this stuff, but they also get pulled to different things. So I think if there was a place to put funding when it comes to that, it would be, you know, strengthening our whole state's ability for law enforcement to actually to be able to dive in and work on these cases. Because I know that that has been, you know, in my experience being a partner of law enforcement, there's times when they're trying to work stuff and then they get pulled on the other stuff and they have done some stings and things in the past, with, you know, there's been, I think, public outcry around why are we spending money on this type of thing? Because it's a victimless crime, which is what it's perceived as in many, like, that's why we talk about the change of culture shift. But, and those are places where we've partnered. So if they identify folks, then we show up and can help support the victims.
I think what you're going to find when the bill is brought before us, the Department of Law will be the primary one presenting the bill. And both the Attorney General and the Assistant Attorney General have viewed it just like you have. They are motivated to bring the law to bear and to catch bad guys, but also give support to victims. And so I think they're highly motivated. What we'll be asking is how will that work down through the law? So we make the law, how does enforcement happen, and then what are the consequences of that? And so we'll do our dead level best to ask them on, you know, how they intend it to work. How it actually will work. We'll probably get the police authorities in here to tell us how they see it working, and then we'll talk about the resource question, and it is how do we put resources to those places that are going to be the first and most important. So, Senator Reinbold.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this, I've looked at the maps and the crime statistics, and it's just horrifying to look at them. So what my question to you is, or Mr. Chairman, is there a rural or native community or a culture in this state where they are absolutely addressing this and having a zero tolerance for sexual abuse and violence? Is there a community that we can look to or leaders in these communities that are actually addressing the problem and it's getting better, so that maybe that model can be used in other places, because it, you know, the adverse experience is horrible, but the murder and of indigenous women is absolutely intolerable. And so, I mean, when I see these things, and then I'm like, why aren't more people in these communities, these cultures, why aren't they doing more? Why aren't leaders in these smaller places?
Go ahead and let him answer it, because I got one more senator up before we gavel out. Any thoughts on that question? I think that's a very good question.
I don't know if there's a particular community within Alaska, as through the chair. As Josh said, a lot of this has been, in terms of sexual exploitation of children, it's been running under the radar. And so I think it's just now, partly through the work of people like Josh and the people at Covenant House and some very dedicated, very small group of law enforcement officers, that this is really coming to light more and more. And this research study that was done through Loyola.
We'll be more on that topic, and believe me, we're going to look for communities. But Senator Keel had one right before we gave
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a question about the most effective paths that we can take as legislators and the most effective things we can do. You know, we've talked about severity of punishment. I think other questions would be certainty of punishment. And you heard my question earlier about, you know, my sense is we can do anything we want with the law. If victims won't testify, there is no punishment. So in terms of the effectiveness of the steps we can take, can you help us with you know, victim safety, resources on prosecution, severity of offense. What are the most effective things? Where should we focus the most work in step one as we work to address all the needs?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair. I do think that, you know, like Senator Machiki talked about, the kind of look in your eye, their eye, and it takes time for the lights to come on. One of the things that we do at Covenant House with all of our young people, not just specifically our trafficked young people, is we've really, because of this ACEs study and because of the understanding of how the brain works and this idea that folks, until they're able to get stable, eat, sleep, have their basic needs met, like they're operating in this part of your brain, the amygdala, and they're just living in survival mode. And you can't physically even get to forward thought until you've had 30 days of stability. So when my answer to that question would be, is we have to help these young people get stable. So if that means creating spaces, you know, for them, like that could mean, like for us, we're applying for some federal funding to try to bring housing specific to trafficking victims to the state. And so it's relationships, it's services, it's getting them connected, it's helping get them stable, because when they're stable, then they can walk through this process and have supports to do so and you know, be able to think through that and make choices to do that. So I think
our goal will be to help you get a healthy, stable society. And bad guys should not be so disruptive. And so as we entertain these bills, that will be our goal, and we'll be glad to work with you. And we are appreciative of your work. What you brought before us obviously has struck a chord, and rightfully so. And so we'll take it to heart, and we'll work with you. With that, I appreciate all of you being here. The testimony that you gave is important and timely, and is going to create an impatience in our work to help you solve some of the problems and help our people. With that, we're going to adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Senators. Thank you.